Hello, this is Chad Huber. I am the producer and one of the co-hosts of the Secular Perspective podcast. We are located here in Indianapolis. We are a podcast that basically explores the concepts of faith, religion, world news, all of that just from the perspective of secular hosts. Last fall, we had the honor of interviewing an author of a book and all about women and atheism and religion and stuff like that. She was nice enough to actually reach out to us to see if we would help promote her book, and we said yes, and this is a clip from that. Hey everybody, this is Chad.
This is Amanda.
And this is Anthony.
And you're listening to the Secular Perspective Secular Perspective podcast. Man, I'm so anxious to get through this. I can't spit it out.
What's a podcast? I've never heard of that. How do you download that?
I know. on iTunes. So in our first big podcast, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but we have a guest, people. We actually have like a good legitimate guest, not just like a friend that I pulled in to say, hey, you want to record this with me? We actually have like a person with extra letters behind her name.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got, you usually go by Karen Garst or Karen L. Garst, whenever.
Well, Karen Garst is
just
fine.
Karen Garst. We got Karen Garst, PhD. She's an author. She has her own blog. She does all kinds of stuff. I'm going to stop right there because I know I'm probably leaving stuff out and butchering this. So you tell me for a second everything about you.
Oh, wow.
Well, okay, not everything about you, but, you know, the Reader's Digest version. Like,
okay, well, I was born that don't in know North you. Dakota, so the chances are that I was Lutheran were pretty high.
Okay.
Everyone I knew, you know, this is in the 50s, everyone I knew went to church or synagogue. There was one Catholic church, a lot of Lutheran ones. I went to Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, which is a Lutheran college, but it was really pretty liberal. My first class in Religion 101 talked about the different oral strains of the Old Testament, which, of course, I had never heard of in church. And then I got a doctorate from the University of Wisconsin, moved to Oregon. I've been a union organizer, director of the Community College Association, and executive director of the Oregon State Bar. And in 2014, I was having lunch with a friend of mine who's an author, and she said, Karen, you should write a book. Well, it happened to be 2 days after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby, where the court held that Hobby Lobby, a privately held company, because of its religious views, didn't have to provide certain birth control to its female employees under the Affordable Care Act. And I said, well, the only thing I could write a book about is atheism. And that started my journey, and I learned out what a blog was and a podcast, and here I am today. And the name of the book is Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion.
Here's what that looks like, by the way. It's been in my desk drawer. I don't hear me zoom in on it for everybody.
You mean your nightstand, and it's well used? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. There we go. It's zoomed in now. What's really funny is like 2 weeks ago, I think, there was a lady on Facebook that I'm friends with, actually part of our dinner group that I was telling you about earlier, that it was one of those Facebook things where it's like, oh, here's a picture that you posted a year ago.
And oh, yeah.
And it was a picture of your book. I was like, oh, my gosh, I am getting ready to talk to this lady in a couple of weeks.
So, oh, yeah. That's a coincidence.
So Yvonne will be pretty interested to listen to this episode whenever it comes out. So,
oh, great.
Now, did the Hobby Lobby decision have you put the feminist spin on this, or were you always kind of leaning that way?
Oh, I need to turn those
well,
for the book.
Yeah, and I just wrote a piece for my blog on third wave feminism, of course, which I had never heard about because I came of age in the 60s and 70s. I've been a member of NOW and NARAL since the early 80s. So, you know, I was kind of oblivious, but yeah, I've always been a feminist. In fact, when I was at Concordia College, abortion was only legal in New York. And we wanted to put out our student newspaper and advertise the phone number you called in New York if you wanted to schedule or get an abortion or get more information. And, of course, this is a Lutheran college. So the president impounded all the newspapers.
Oh, my God.
They were destroyed. They weren't sent out. We couldn't even advertise about it. So I've been an activist for a long time.
And so you got 22 women together. How did you find 22 female atheists? I don't know of many people that are
I want to know that too
that are out about that kind of thing. So
yeah, and you know, I think when I first started this project, of course, I knew about Richard Dawkins and had read The God Delusion, etc. I looked at the top best-selling books, the 100 top best-selling books on atheism on Amazon, and only 6 were written by women.
Right.
And I think, you know, you will hear, you'll see articles about why aren't there more women atheists? So I decided to focus on women because I think their voice needs to be heard and because we all need models. When I was growing up, the models I had were secretary, nurse, or teacher. I started out as a teacher. And it's not that you can't be something you don't see. It's just, it doesn't seem real likely for you. It's like that little boy, African-American boy who saw Obama. What a change, saying somebody like me can be president. Wow, that's going to change that boy's life because he's going to see a possibility for himself that he didn't see before.
Right.
So I think it's really important to have role models. So maybe we just don't have enough women atheists who are role models. So I decided that early on, and I started out asking my friends. My friend Jill was born in England, and in England, when, I don't know if you know this, but when you're looking for something, the directions are given, it's a block from the Lucky Lab. I mean, they're always the next pub, you know, that's how you give directions. And she moved first to the United States in the South. And there they go, oh, it's by the Presbyterian Church. And she's going, I don't know where any of the churches are. How am I going to find anything? So I started out with friends. I hadn't joined any secular groups. So I started to go to those and got people who were interested. And then I reached out through social media and ended up with 22 women, 18 to 70. Some of them were born abroad in different countries. They all live in the United States now. And ask each of them to write their personal stories. And it's quite a variety of stories.
Yeah, I read most of this book like back at the beginning of the year when you and I had first talked about this. So it's like I don't remember tons of it that I read back then. But I remember as I was going from story to story, I guess it depended on which story I was reading, but I remember my emotions shifting from story to story. Like some of them I felt were kind of uplifting, others I felt was kind of depressing as I was going through it. I think just putting myself in the shoes of the author of that particular essay, it's like, man, I just can't believe somebody would go through this. But I mean, clearly they did. I'm not going to accuse any of these people of lying, clearly.
Well, let me just hard read for you me an to excerpt from one of the first stuff. One. That is one of those that it's depressing. But it's what a lot of people go through. So I'll just read a couple paragraphs of that.
Yeah, please.
Please.
And it's Ann Wilcox, and it's a pseudonym because her family doesn't know.
Okay.
Gotcha.
As I tried to let my beliefs go, my head seemed far ahead of the rest of me. I would think, that makes no sense. But I would be assailed by intense fear and doubt. I felt that all my old fears and beliefs still skulking inside, like the biblical Leviathan, a sea monster that lurked in the deep. I felt wrong, as though I had committed a terrible crime and I was going to be punished. Whenever I got near anything to do with my religion, a Christian coworker, a bumper sticker, a debate or a speaker, something on the internet or the news, even or especially my own family, I went into a tailspin of dread and doubt for days. I kept thinking the fear would diminish, but it went on for months and months. My fear was so ingrained that as I wrestled with my beliefs, I had shadowy nightmares. And I felt like things were creeping up on me in the middle of the night. As I sat in my chair reading, there were times when I involuntarily glanced upward, as if lightning might strike through my ceiling. When I attacked my beliefs about Satan, it felt as if he was in my room with me. This was a complete surprise, not to mention freaky. After 30 years away from my religion, my mind was still being assaulted with the irrational fear for disbelieving. And she, of course, was raised as a fundamentalist. And I think that if you look and read the psychologist's perspective, that inculcation of shame and guilt during childhood really shapes a person's psyche. And it's difficult to get rid of. Now, I want to end with a good part of that story. She called me a few months ago and said she was at our beautiful beach in Oregon, sitting on a rock, and she said, I had an epiphany. I'm okay. I'm a good person. And she really thought that writing, and she didn't just write this essay. When she left the church, she wrote hundreds of pages to process it. But I think we don't forget, we forget what it's like for a child that only has their parents to learn from in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And their mom and dad, they got to be right. And if they tell you, not only do you sin, but you are sin, that's going to last with you like it did with Anne for decades, even after she had renounced her faith.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that what stuck out to me was, it stuck out to me really early on, was the context of this and the unique perspectives of women particularly, because the essay that really stuck out, where that really jumped out at me, was about the Jehovah's Witness.
Ooh.
And, you know, she was sitting there describing as being in church, and she has this natural talent for public speaking, but in the Jehovah's Witness faith, women are not allowed to preach, not even attempt it or be anything close to preaching. And she has this natural talent that's being, you know, pushed away, stifled, you know, but, and it's just like, that's a unique thing that as a man, I never experienced that, you know, I never experienced something like that just because I was born with a penis,
right.
You know, but she experienced it because she was born with a uterus. And like, that's, mm-hmm. that's something that has to be, like you said, there needs to be more, needs to be more literature and more, activism from women who fall into this category, because that's something I don't think a lot about. And that's why I appreciated the book and these essays and these women sharing their stories publicly. That was my favorite part of the book, I think, was just me getting over, or just me realizing that stuff, or, you know, associating that with this cause. And I think you did a great job, and these women did a great job shining a light on that.
I think, well, in reading all the essays, some women were really grappling with it. Some women, it was like, well, I've always been an atheist. It's not a big deal. But gender discrimination was an overarching theme, I think, in every single essay. And I think that's something very inherent with religion that women have to process, is you're not as good as a man. If you buy into religion, you're not as good as a man. Mm-hmm. And I saw hints of that in every single essay. But aside from the gender discrimination, was there any other, like, themes that you picked up on from women that are atheists at all?
Well, let me answer that later, but I wanted to go back to what you said about women. And, you know, the research I've done in the last couple of years, I really didn't know anything about this, but it is believed early on that there was worship of a female divine. And so you go back and look at all the figurines from the Paleolithic or the Neolithic and what's happening in the Mediterranean. There were female deities. And it makes a lot of sense, because you start out with the earth and with cycles. And you can you imagine Paleolithic man going, I go hunting and I get stabbed and I bleed and I die. And yet this woman here bleeds every month and doesn't die. And you've got the cycles of the moon, and there's 13 of them, and she's got 13 cycles. So, you know, it kind of makes sense. But what did we lose? What did we lose by excluding women, not just from the divine, but from access to education? Where would this world be today if people like Hypatia of Alexandria were the norm rather than exception. And by the way, of course, she was murdered by a Christian mob and her skin scraped away with clamshells.
Go figure.
In Alexandria. And so that, to me, it's the, here you have this woman who is totally capable of everything and yet gets excluded. whether, like you said, Anthony, she gets excluded from public speaking, or she gets excluded from school, or she's not encouraged to do this, or she's not encouraged to do that. What a loss to all of humanity. And I don't think I answered your question, so I'll let you ask it again.
Any other themes that you picked up? Well, maybe just...